Hello and welcome to another episode of History of Westeros Podcast, a podcast dedicated to George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series, as well as HBO's Game of Thrones. Today, we are discussing the Battle of Fire. Dun, dun, dun!
We're huge fans of all five books, obviously. I'm sure you knew that by now. But we can't deny that A Dance of Dragons left us hanging more than any of the other previous books.
No offense to Brienne, as she was literally left hanging at the end of Feast.
On one hand, this makes us more anxious to find out what happens. On the other hand, the Winds of Winter is shaping up to be very exciting. We have at least six significant battles or conflicts that are set to resolve early out in the book. We have Aegon VI in the Golden Company at Storm's End.
Mm-hmm. Cersei's trial by combat.
We have Daenerys in the Dothraki Sea with Khal Jako.
The fallout from Jon's Julius Caesar treatment.
The Battle of Winterfell, a.k.a. the Battle of Ice. And the topic of this episode, the Battle of Fire, a.k.a. the Battle of Meereen. So today, we're not really the history of Westeros, more like the future of Essos.
As an aside, we called the Battle of Winterfell the Battle of Ice, and it might seem a little silly to call it that, because the real Battle of Ice might happen in this in the Winds of Winter as well. And of course, we're talking about some sort of invasion from the others.
Yeah, as frozen as Stannis and his men are, we'd have to think that the others could do something far worse than just a heavy snowstorm.
But today, we're in Slaver's Bay, which is a much hotter place, where there are many relevant chapters have been read by George at various cons.
Yeah, we've collected what we know about these readings that pertain to the situation at Meereen, and we've analyzed them to death, as we usually do, History of Westeros style.
So if it isn't clear by now, this is an extremely spoilery episode. Mega spoilery, you might
say. Yeah,
I
would say it's probably almost certainly the most spoilery episode we've ever done.
Well, the Arianne sample chapter was equally, but this has more sample chapters, so yeah. Yes, I suppose.
And these haven't been actually published, or just read at conventions.
Yeah, that's so also true.
It's a little bit different, but anyway. I fully respect anyone who doesn't want to be spoiled, that wants to keep these things a surprise. And of course some of the material may change slightly, but some of us just can't. We just can't wait. Mm-hmm. All but one of these readings were summarized by people who were there to listen to them. So the content should be taken with a grain of salt, as people can make mistakes.
Mm-hmm. The one exception is the first Victarion chapter, which we have the exact text of because it was recorded and posted to YouTube and someone transcribed it.
Well, about half of it anyway.
half of it is recorded.
And we'll have a link to that in the description for this video and in the description for the podcast, so you can mm-hmm. find that for yourself if you haven't seen it already. Mm-hmm. It's only fair to mention that some of these details could change when the book actually comes out. Because we've been through this process before with Dance and with Feast. We were anxiously awaiting those for several years, and we saw the same exact process. But since we have been through this before, I can also tell you that these changes tend to be fairly minor. Maybe he words something differently, small detail here and there, nothing major for the most part. So we expect that this, what we're telling you today, will mostly remain the same in the book, in other words.
Mm-hmm. As you said, we've included the links to all the chapters discussed in the we're going to have it in the description on YouTube, as well as in the Facebook post. So if you're listening on iTunes, you just head on over to Facebook or to YouTube to find the links, or do some Googling yourself.
Now, George isn't going to give us massive spoilers at these convention readings, so expect this to be really interesting and fun, but don't expect to have any huge plot points or revelations come out of it. We don't want to make you expecting that and then have you disappointed. But there is a lot of really cool stuff in here. Don't let me dampen the mood at all here. And personally, I don't read Song of Ice and Fire to be shocked or surprised, although that does happen, and it's fun when it does. Those things are nice, but if you're spoiled on a few events and details, you're not going to be spoiled on the prose, the brilliant descriptions, or the way you'll actually feel when you get the book finally in your hands for the first time, or ebook, or whatever, whatever medium you happen to digest it in. So, if there's one caveat to that is there's one thing that perhaps I regret having been spoiled on in previous books, and that's finding out who the new point of views are. Mm-hmm. But there aren't any new point of views this time, at least not in these chapters that we're talking about.
He's not planning on there being any new point of views, period, besides the prolonged epilogues.
That's true. So he may change his mind, but if that's the case, we haven't learned that yet, and it certainly does not affect what we're discussing today. So
the Battle of Meereen involves parallel Tyrion, Barristan, and Victarion chapters. And that these group chapters, you know, are, there's three point of views that we're viewing the battle through, that's by itself pretty noteworthy. If you compare it to the Battle of Blackwater, we also have three point of views there, but Davos is one of them, and he's out of action fairly quickly.
Yeah, so this is kind of, this is potentially something bigger than we've ever seen as far as battles go. Speaking of Blackwater, by the way, they spent $50 million on that episode, Season 2, Episode 9. And that was half of the Season 2 budget.
Yeah.
And if you think about this one, as we go through it and we describe what's happening, of course, there's going to be dragons in this one. That's already a huge
Dragons expense. On pyramids. There are dragons on the big pyramids. You know, the landscape. I mean, the wildfire is stunning, and they had to spend, but dragons on periods. So, for anyone who's been bored by Marine, you should keep it in mind that what this will look like on TV. And I could definitely see them going over 50 million for this battle.
It's going to be huge. It's really exciting. So anyway, yeah, like she said, anyone who's been bored with Marine before, that ends today. By the end of this podcast, you will feel differently about that, I'm guessing. I'm going to go ahead and bet on that. Before we get to the new information, it's important to backtrack a little, keep track of what's happened at the end of Dance with Dragons, refresh ourselves and what those characters were doing, so it all kind of makes sense, and you don't need to go back and go, wait, wasn't he doing this or that? Anyway, we just good. It's important to recap. So we'll start with Victarion.
Yeah, Victarion's orders from Euron specifically are he wants to get Dany and her dragons, but Victarion plots betrayal, and he intends to do to Euron what Euron did to him many years ago, which was steal his woman.
Yeah.
Not that Daenerys is even Euron's woman, but he will steal her before he even has her. He has a plan to blow the horn. But, I mean, we're not so sure that he has thought this through after, you know, after that point. Like, you blow it, how are you going to make her like you? Bunch of things. Tons of stuff he hasn't considered.
Blow horn?
Yeah, that's it.
Step one, blow, step two?
Yeah.
Step three, profit?
Yeah, profit.
But something very peculiar happened to him, Victarion, at the end of his final dance chapter. When Mikoro does whatever he does to Vic's hand, the point of view stops, sort of, and the chapter continues.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, we're reading from the narrator's point of view.
And it's interesting that this is something that Aziz pointed out in our notes, is that when reading it, I had never really noticed the change of point of view. It wasn't particularly noteworthy to me, but when reading it again, which I'm about to read it out loud, you really see that it's very different from the normal.
It's kind of spooky.
Yeah, it's a little spooky. So, the Iron Captain was not seen again that day, but as the hours passed, the crew of his Iron Victory reported hearing the sound of wild laughter coming from the captain's cabin, laughter deep and dark and mad. And when Longwater Pike and Wolf One-Eye tried the cabin door, they found it barred. Later singing was heard, a strange, high, wailing song in a tongue the maester said was High Valyrian. That was when the monkeys left the ship, screeching as they leapt into the water.
That's pretty cool. I love that quote. Yeah. By the way, it's something kind of funny that happens to us. We get a lot of our info from these ebooks, and occasionally they have typos or just wrong words. I think there's an example there. I think that's Wolf One Ear, and in our notes it says Wolf One Eye, and we cut and pasted it from the ebook, so I don't know. Anyway, that's just funny.
Yeah, frequently. Daenerys Stormhorn.
Yeah, we saw Daenerys Stormhorn in my copy of Clash of Kings ebook the other day. Stormhorn. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yes.
So, some take this section, this part of the chapter, to mean that Victarion maybe, like, died in there or something. Kind of like Beric Dondarrion, raised again, and he still seems like himself, but maybe with some small changes to his personality. But from Victarion, maybe we wouldn't notice that. I don't know. But a vision that Dany sees way back in the House of the Undying kind of backs this theory up a bit.
A corpse stood at the prow of a ship, eyes bright in his dead face, gray lips smiling sadly.
Gray lips smiling sadly, Greyjoy. That fits pretty darn well. And a corpse standing at the prow of a ship. Yeah, that part, so that's the part about why we think maybe he's now dead. The color of his black and charred skin of his left hand, by the way, sounds kind of like Mikoro's skin everywhere. He's described as soot black, not like black like, you know, black people, like, who are actually brown, you know? I mean, he's black, like actual black. So maybe he's been burned. I've kind of had that theory for a while, but no way to prove it. Anyway, so it kind of sounds like Victorian might be undead.
Yeah.
No big deal, right?
I think, towards it being Victorian. The only other real candidate that I can think of is John Connington.
Right.
But I don't think he necessarily fits it exactly right. Especially because they've landed, you know. But that's the only other contender I can think of, really.
Yeah.
But so I do think it's Victorian.
And of course, because we mentioned John Connington because he gets gray scale, so
yeah, oh,
gray
yeah.
lips, smiling sadly. But I don't know where the smiling sadly. But that's the part that doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't think we have.
Yeah,
a good
he's the only other
that.
Person I can think of that remotely fits. I
yeah.
guess Shireen.
Yeah, Shireen.
She has gray scale. It could be her. But anyways, well, maybe Victorian. During the Great Voyage from the Iron Islands. Victorian is a bit confused about how many of his ships turn up missing. He wasn't expecting to lose so many. And one theory regarding this says that Euron is actually tailing him, and the missing ships are not actually missing, but waiting for him, waiting with him, preparing to swoop in and prevent Victorian's predictable betrayal.
I don't believe this myself for several reasons, but it is worth throwing out there. If Euron could get that much of the Iron Fleet to turn on Victorian, he doesn't need Vic at all, I would think. But he could just taken the Iron Fleet over there himself.
Mm-hmm. The counter argument to that is that he might need Victorian's presence for some other purpose, to do the dirty work.
Yeah. Euron may consider Victorian better than him in terms of leading troops directly into battle. I'm sure Euron thinks of himself as superior in general, but Victorian has a lot more experience with this particular sort of engagement in battle in general. Euron's more of a planner. And he's a good fighter, too, but Victorian's the, like... You know, the big champion guy that everyone rallies behind. So
glories in the battle.
Well. He certainly does. But it also could have something to do with him wanting, you know, Victorian to take the heat, maybe the dangerous, you know, that's kind of the same as saying the dirty work. But it also could have something to do with the Dragonhorn.
Mm-hmm. Mm. But the other thing, though, is that Euron is also at war with the Reach. It's highly likely, more likely, in my opinion, that he's directing this himself and not following Victorian. I think he's got to be going for Oldtind and Highgarden and being down in the Reach.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine him starting a war with the Reach, which is far more populous than
and
the
not
Arnolds.
Being there.
And then leaving, yeah. That would be kind of silly.
But it's a theory that people have, so we throw it out there.
Yeah, so yeah, just in case you were one of the people entertaining that theory, we wanted to address that, so... Euron most likely realizes that Victorian plans to betray him. After all, he seems to be much smarter than his brother, and he seems to know his brother pretty well as well. He's probably prepared for this eventuality. He probably suspects it's going to happen. He does seem to need Dany, though. He does intend to take the Iron Throne, and I don't think that he can just take the Iron Throne himself as a Greyjoy. I think he would need more legitimacy than that, so a Targaryen bride might really help that. Bottom line, though, Euron is quite cunning, and he's not going to be outflanked or outfought by his brother, Victorian. I just do not see that happening. Victorian doesn't have that kind of brain power. I think he's foreseen much and planned quite a bit.
But one thing that Euron could not have foreseen or planned around is Mokhor, who is the wild card.
Wild card.
First of all, there are some who think Mokhor is Marwyn, but I think this is impossible. Mokoro seems to be well-known to noteworthy people, such as Benero, who's the high priest of the Temple to R'hllor in Volantis.
Mm-hmm. Has a whole sling of, whole slew of exciting titles.
Mm-hmm. He's supporting Daenerys.
He is supporting Daenerys. He hasn't exactly told Victorian this, but the Red Priests are clearly allied with Daenerys. They think she's Azor Ahai. This is some sort of manipulation is likely here, but we're not really exactly sure how it's going to come. Something that hasn't yet happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. But how will Mokhor actually impact Euron's plans? Mokhor tells us in Dance that the Horn must be claimed with blood. And so perhaps the Horn had already been bound to Euron, and Mokhor is going to change this. Because maybe, you know, Euron, he could see that Victorian wouldn't blow the horn himself. He knows better than that. He can see that. But his plan likely hinged on Victorian not realizing that he needs to claim the horn with blood himself. Mokhor might have ruined that plan, but perhaps Euron has another trick up his sleeve.
Yeah. Mokhor says the horn must be claimed by blood, she said. Surely Euron knows this. It's written on the side of the horn in Valyrian glyphs, apparently. And at the end of the chapter, Mokhor asks Victorian if he should bleed him. Claim with blood, if he should bleed him. I don't know if something related to that. Vic says that the Dusky Woman will do it for him. Can something be done with his blood? Can the Dusky Woman or Mokhor even be trying to get some of his blood to manipulate the horn somehow?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, King's Blood is, we've all heard about the value of King's Blood. The power of King's Blood comes up in numerous places throughout the series, with different people involved, different types of magic involved. But this is a common thread throughout all of them.
You know, they
So
have,
does his blood
we have the dick
qualify?
blood of Gendry, of course.
The most startling example, probably,
Yeah,
of
it's what
this
they
being
used on
used.
Joffrey. But anyways, almost without a doubt, the Greyjoy line is full of kings, including his brothers Balon and Euron, as they themselves claim.
There you go.
But they also claim to descent from the legendary Grey King himself, the first king of the Iron Isles. So yes, he does have king's blood in his line.
Yep. For more proof, if you didn't, if you don't believe us, I assume you do. But if you need more proof that Euron is pulling the strings on Victarion, there's this great quote by Mokoro.
I have seen you in the night fires, Victarion Greyjoy. You come striding through the flames, stern and fierce, your great axe dripping blood, blind to the tentacles that grasp you at wrist and neck and ankle, the black strings that make you dance.
Of course, Victorian doesn't like being told that he's dancing. That's his reaction, is dancing. He just kind of ignores the rest of it, the underlying meaning. He's like, dancing? I don't dance. What are you talking about? Yeah, missing the point there, buddy. One person who definitely doesn't like Mokoro is the aforementioned dusky woman. She hisses at him when she sees him for the first time. She's smiling when Victorian walks in, and then she sees who's behind him, and she hisses at him like
She wants to be the only black person on the ship, obviously. I mean, no, but a popular theory is that the Dusky Woman is a faceless man. That seems a little, might seem a bit crazy. I mean, after all, this person keeps having sex with Victarion. Like, that's a commitment to your cause. I'm also doubting that a faceless man would lose composure like that. And we see from Arya's chapters how well they train the reactions, and I can't see a reason why she would want to show that reaction, which could maybe be the counterpoint. But why would she want to lead on that she doesn't like him? So,
Yeah, it seems like a real reaction. It's an uncontrolled, like, whoa, I didn't expect to see you or
So
someone
yeah,
like you or
I think
whatever.
faceless man is I would is not what's the case,
I agree, I
but
agree. It was worth mentioning, and we know that Euron had a faceless man
yes.
before, so it could be
He
no, could
keeps
be the
one on
same person.
retainer.
Yeah, he's on retainer. It's, yeah, he's super. He's a lot richer than we thought. So Mokoro hints a bit that the Dusky Woman, in fact, will kill or is killing the captain when he says the following quote, "Your death is with us now, my lord. Give me your hand." She's standing right there with us now, as the quote says, and we know that all of Euron's gifts are poisoned. Victarion himself says that line, or thinks that line several times. All of Euron's gifts are poisoned. In this case, it might be literal. The young maester who was treating his hand, seemed perplexed by how his hand wasn't healing properly. And it could be that the Dusky Woman was doing something sneaky. Like, she couldn't get away with just slitting his throat. That would be too obvious. But if he dies of this infected wound, no one's going to blame her.
Why
Remember
does he,
that.
why do they want them to die, though, before he blows the horn?
Yeah, that
She
part I
wants
don't
him to
understand.
be close to death, so that he blows the horn and then goes for the last thing. You know, I don't know. But
Or perhaps that Euron needs him to be dead, but he couldn't have foreseen Mokoro being there. So it's
Dusky
all.
Woman could be acting on her own accord. She's like, I fucking hate this guy.
Now, so it's also important to mention that there's at least a couple of times where Victarion mentions that she's going to do some of the work on his wound. After the maester cleans it out in that one scene, he has her bind the wound up. So she's got plenty of opportunity to have manipulated his wound. And of course, they're sleeping together. So, I mean, it's not like that's the only access he has to her. So.
But I mean, what are the odds that Euron sent his brother and the Iron Island's best fleet, his best ships, across the world on a super important mission without putting some spies and loyal men or women in his ship?
Especially given that what our earlier point about how he's pretty much figured out that Victorian's going to betray him, because I think he knew that all along. Before he even told him the plan, he was like, okay, he's going to betray me, and I'm going to do this and respond to that, etc. But what something peculiar, Victorian wanted to kill her right away because he realized, well, this came from Euron. I don't want her because all of Euron's gifts are poisoned. But he just doesn't. He just doesn't kill her. That's the way he thinks of it in his own mind. He just doesn't. So she could be loyal to Euron and not a faceless man, of course. She could just be some agent of his. That seems a lot more likely to us. But, we got to throw up all the possibilities.
You know, a lot of people characterize Victarion as a dumb brute. but they seem to ignore some complex psychological issues that Victorian has regarding women. I mean, among other things, but, you know, Euron, but... Yeah.
Man doesn't know how to laugh. I mean, that's an issue right there.
Yeah, that said, Victorian is very subject to manipulation. Euron seems to be an excellent manipulator, and so choosing a female spy is pretty clever for Victorian.
Yeah,
and I mean, in A Dance of Dragons, Victorian is already seeing her as enough for him in terms of having female companionship.
Mm-hmm.
He just wants a woman to love him.
He wants to love and be loved. That's all he really wants. Behind
he's a lover, not a fighter.
Behind that.
He's a lover and a fighter.
He's both. He just doesn't know he's a lover yet. Now, like I said before, Euron certainly did hire a faceless man already. That's how he killed Balon. And he may have even paid for it with a dragon egg. This could be the same faceless man. So if it is that, we've kind of connected those dots. If not, well, you know, we didn't. So take your pick. Faceless man, other magical type control conspiracy, or, you know, just Euron knowing his brother really well, manipulating him.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's both. Yes. Yeah, it could be both.
All right, now, moving on from Victorian. Tyrion has just snuck away from slavery thanks to the chaos caused by, you know, his master, the Yellow Whale, a very funny guy, contracting the Pale Mare. He was the Yellow Whale and the Pale Mare.
So many mares. Yeah. So many animals, rather.
So many animals. He makes lavish promises to the Second Sons in the form of massive rewards, and he signs his name to documents proving this. And that's the price for him to join the company, and Jorah and Penny join with him.
Yeah. So now to Meereen and Ser Barristan. Mm-hmm. In the Kingbreaker chapter, the Shave Pate explains the Yunkish motivations with seeming perfection. He kind of lays it all out for us, and for Ser Barristan, who's not the most astute political guy. But unlike many others who are or were bad at intrigue, Ned Stark, Barristan fully recognizes his own shortcomings and takes advice from those we recognize as aware and relatively trustworthy. Now, why is Skaz, the Shave Pate, so trustworthy? Oh, well, that's because he has pretty much opposed everyone that Daenerys has considered an enemy, and he's committed to it by, you know, getting people killed and joining the Shave Pate movement in general, and really marks him as someone who's changing the old guard. So he, if Daenerys' cause is lost, he's toast himself. So he's an ally, if not by circumstance and true loyalty, by necessity. So.
Yes. So, I mean, even a man with no taste for intrigue like Barristan, he does recognize this. He realizes that he can trust the Shave Pate.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be too complicated to realize that this guy's life is depending on the same things his and Barristan.
So Skaz, what he says, he tells essentially that after executing Admiral Grolio, the Young Kai had 6 hostages. 3 of them were King Hisdar's kin, who have been returned. Dario, Jogo, and Hero remain captive, and how convenient that is.
Yeah. The Shave Pate calls this a sham. We agree. Yes. I mean, the hostages returned are Hisdar's kin, and the other 3 are Dany's, like, top people, basically. Like, he couldn't have balanced that out a little bit. It was kind of blatant. Yeah. Skaz believes that Hisdar will balk at the killing of the dragons. That's what the Yunkish are demanding. Hisdar is going to, by balking at this, it allows him to buy some time. It'll make him look like he's loyal. It's kind of a show of showing loyalty to Daenerys. Like, I can't kill her dragons. I can't do that. But Hisdar, of course, if you recall, he didn't hesitate at all when Drogon came out, attacked the fighting pits there, and he was screaming, kill the dragon, kill the dragon. So that's kind of inconsistent. But also the delay allows the Yunkai to use, as an excuse to execute one or more of the hostages. You know, that way they can get rid of Dario or Hero or, Jogo. The sham can continue, as Hisdar can now claim, because they're executing more hostages. He's like, oh, now I have no choice. I have to kill the dragons, or Dany's other beloved captains will be killed. Oh, woe is me. What choice do I have?
Bottom line is that the Volantine fleet is on its way, and the last thing any fleet wants to deal with is dragons. Mm. Sails, wood, nowhere to hide.
this can't be understated, really.
During Aegon's conquest, the Targaryen navy was defeated by the Aryan navy. So Visenya rode forth on Vhagar and burned the entire Aaron fleet alone. So yeah,
keep that in mind. That's nasty. So, and the Valentines are aware of this. The youngish are aware of this. They're like,
they believe me. The Valentines know about dragons.
Yeah, they are. They're probably a couple of them are real nervous about that, if not more of them. Anyway, Skaz is insistent that they have to strike first. They can't just wait for this sham to play itself out while they sit there twiddling their thumbs, losing time and the initiative. So Barristan refuses, saying that they must uphold the honor of the queen's peace, of their honor and the queen's peace, which is, you know, not what we're advocating and what Skaz was suggesting. So Barristan agrees, at least though, to question the king regarding the poison locust. He at least agrees that something's up there and that needs to be pursued. And he intends to allow Dany to judge the king after meeting with his Dar and realizing that he probably was lying. He kind of feels like he was lying. He doesn't really believe his excuses, so he imprisons him. But he, as just the hand, his unofficial title that everyone's calling him, decides that he isn't can't be the one to execute the king. So he has to let Dany come back and do that. However, right when this happens, right when Hisdar is arrested and put into jail, is the precise moment that Quentin's plan goes all, you know, bad, and the dragons escape. So there's all these things happening at once.
Hisdar's imprisonment precipitates the return of the nightly murders, and at a faster pace. The Sons of the Harpies, their murders. The Green Grace and the others. The Green Grace, she's such a nice chick. I'm sure she has everyone's best interest in mind. She's certainly not creepy at all. They urge Sir Barristan to kill the dragons so that there can be a return to peace, and the hostages can, you know, be returned. But he delays. He's trying to ransom the hostages. Missandei suggests offering a huge sum so that the sellswords in the employ of the Yunkai will be upset they refuse.
So, meanwhile, Viserion and Rhaegal are loose in the city, each having taken a pyramid as new home. Ancient Myrinese families lived in these pyramids. So the hostile dragon takeovers, it's a new term, hostile dragon takeovers, did cause a few casualties. That's a good band name, yeah. The fighting pits have been filled with animals at Sir Barristan's command, so that when the dragons roam for food, they have an easy place to go and get some and not have to cause any extra destruction, kind of minimize the danger, or rather the damage that they're doing throughout town.
So, the Yunkai response to the ransom offer? Just fling plague-infested corpses over the walls. This, of course, means that war is unavoidable. Yep. In fact, war has begun.
That's pretty much the start.
Like you're swinging, you're flinging the plague into the city.
Yeah, that's not nothing you do to your friends or your people that you're trying to build peace with. So now that's the background. That's the setup. That's basically what happened at the end of Dance of Dragons. Now let's get into the actual new material, the actual sample Winds of Winter chapters.
The length compared to Blackwater seems to indicate at least 6 to 7 chapters. Blackwater was 6. With the number of point of views in mind alongside that, this is definitely looking like an extremely epic battle. I mean, it already is an epic battle based on what we know. To be clear, we have 5 confirmed Battle of Fire chapters, and we can take a guess at there being 1 or 2 more chapters due to the length of Blackwater. Comparatively, it seems like it makes sense that there would be at least equal amount as Blackwater. So we can assume there's probably 1 more chapter.
Yeah, and also it's also based on the action at the time.
Also based on the action,
this isn't
quite
over yet.
True.
There must be at least one more chapter.
There must be at least one more chapter.
Two.
I'm thinking 2, but...
And also, just as a mathematical percentage of the book type of thing, that probably represents 6 chapters, 7 chapters. 7 chapters would be probably about 8 to 9% of the book, just to give you an idea of how big the book is and of how big the battle is. So we're able to guess effectively at the chapter order based on partly on how the action unfolds. It's easy to see that some things happen before others. Some things sometimes it's pretty obvious. Yeah. But also, George is really good about making sure the characters take note of what time of day it is based on the position of the sun, things like that. So we can connect the dots that way as well. That really helps us.
One way this could be 6 or 7 chapters would be if the prologue takes place at the Battle of Meereen. Perhaps Marwyn arriving and then promptly dying, as is the custom. And it would certainly be nice to see into his head, at least, though I don't want him to die particularly, but that's about the only chance we have to see into his head. And it also fits in with the general the general
the pattern of the prologue chapters.
Yeah, the exact pattern which he does, you know, southern, northern, etc. So, we're going to go into each chapter in more detail throughout the episode. You can refer to the chapters themselves during this episode, or you can come in blind. We're going to give you just a slight overview of what you can expect, what each chapter, like, so you can kind of tell as we go through the actual details, you can know, you know, that this was a Barristan chapter, or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. The first one is, in fact, a Barristan chapter, mm-hmm. and we are referring to it as Sound the Attack. We've given each of the chapters a little nickname to kind of remind what they are, what the key points are in them. Mm-hmm. But we're really, when we describe the action, we're sort of going to describe it all together as one amalgam, so it's easier to keep track of. So that'll be kind of fun. It's almost like telling a story. In one of the readings, we have the reason we call it Sound the Attack, rather, is because Barristan makes a really rousing speech. We don't have the actual speech, but apparently it's great. and after the speech, in one of the readings, George specifically tells us that there's next a Victorian chapter, and then a Tyrion chapter, and then a second Barristan chapter. So we know that order, like, almost for sure.
Yes. So then, after Barristan, there would then be Victorian 1, as he said, which we're calling Trojan Ships. We learned of his plans for the battle and for the Dragonborn. That's the one that half of it has been released, and it seems that all of it has been read. Mm-hmm. So
we have maybe a little more precise detail.
Yeah,
on
that's the most one we have the most precise detail on. Well, Tyrion, you know, and we only have half, but you know.
Yeah. Half of it specifically written out and half of it read out loud, then notes taken. So, you know. Anyway, so in Tyrion 1, which would be next, we call it flipping and flopping. that refers both the bodies flying as they're hurled by trebuchets and to the back and forth nature of sellsword loyalty. Mm-hmm.
Then we have a second Barristan chapter where we have some major battle actions, so we're calling it I Came for Blood, Not Gold. This is a quote for this three books, really, because it's reminiscent of the Red Vipers, you raped her, quote, which is funny because this line comes from the Red Lamb.
Yeah, another red guy.
Red animal. Another animal.
Red animal, that's right. Yeah. Then we have Tyrion 2. Well, we're kind of assuming Tyrion 2 would be next, but as far as the way the action unfolds, it's a pretty safe bet. Like I said, we're calling it forcing the issue, and what basically is happening there is that Tyrion realizes he needs to act fast because he's on the wrong side, and as usual, this means running his mouth. That's how he usually forces the issue, and he's going to do it to good effect this time. And Penny herself is forcing the issue a bit.
The issue of love. We can guess that right now, right here, this is the chapter we're guessing. We think there's one. We're pretty sure there's one more. We can guess that this is Victorian 2. And this is probably a dragon's descend chapter.
Yeah, we were expecting the horn to get blown in that chapter. Yeah. So, but as far as that goes, that's probably why he hasn't read that chapter yet. It's probably something pretty big happens, either the dragon's coming out or something about his new nature, his arm being revealed, something like that, or maybe just some awesome scenes that he wants to hold on to. In any case, we're gonna have to wait for the book on that.
Mm-hmm.
But will there be a Dany chapter shortly after all this? That's kind of possible.
Yeah.
If she does show up, it would be so much more epic.
Yeah, it would. The thing is that when we last saw her, she was in, you know, she was in the Dothraki Sea. And does she have time to do everything that she needs to do and get there for the battle? We don't think so. I mean, we think she's going to... there's a lot that we think she's going to do. We're not going to get too off topic into Dany because that really doesn't have much to do with the Battlefire, and I don't want to get off topic. But it would be a lot more epic if on TV, you know, there's the battle going on. Everyone's like, "Where's Daenerys? Where's Daenerys?" And then she shows up right at the end of the battle to take control of her dragons, whatever. But that's a little too convenient for George.
Yeah, probably too convenient. The timing would be pretty amazing on that.
Yeah, it would be pretty unbelievable.
So, but more on that later.
Yes. So the battle itself.
Let's talk about the who and the why. In other words, who the participants are, why they're in the battle, what their motivations are, what they want to get out of it, that sort of thing. Starting with Barristan's command, his immediate army and all that. Of course, his most important troops are the Unsullied. Everybody knew that. 5,000 of them are going to commit to the battle, which leaves over 3,000 unaccounted for. And we're assuming those are going to remain behind, stiffened by the City Watch, the Brazen Beasts. They're left behind to make sure nothing happens inside the city, to make sure it holds, and to be a last line of defense if the attack fails. Now, of course, the Brazen Beasts, like I said, are not in Shave Pate's command anymore. They were Hizdar removed the Shave Pate from command and put in another of his cousins. More nepotism, but Shave Pate claims they're still loyal to him.
Mm-hmm. But also note that the Sons of the Harpy could be causing great problems if there aren't sufficient loyal soldiers to keep them at bay, which is why it's very smart to leave behind 3,000 Unsullied. No doubt, like, they would aid the besiegers if the opportunity arose. Screw the Harpy.
Yeah, screw the Harpy.
And then, of course, there are the Shave Pates. Men, you know, who shave their heads to signify their loyalty to Daenerys, that they've left behind the old ways of Geese, which long involved dramatic hair. Really, I can't wait to see all those.
Like horn shaped and like into animals and stuff.
Oh, that'd be cool.
It sounds kind of cool, yeah.
anyways, there's no Shave Pate company or anything, but there are definitely some fighters in the group. They're men, so man, a lot of men are fighters. Those who own mounts could function like Westerosi free riders. In this case, you know, riding to battle with Ser Barristan.
Yeah, right alongside the famous Ser Barristan. There's some freedmen / former slave companies that were formed when Daenerys freed the slaves, obviously. We have the Mother's Men, led by Marcellin. We have the Free Brothers, led by Simon Stripeback. And we have the Stalwart Shields, led by Tal Tarak. They were formerly led by Yolano Moss Dobb, but he fell victim to the Pale Mirror, like so many others.
Then, of course, there are the Dothraki. Very few remain, as though, so they're not really significant at the moment. I mean, Aggo and Ricaro took the bulk of the small Khalasar to the Dothraki Sea to search for the Queen.
Right, so they're not around. Barristan's squires, who we get to learn a bit about them at the end of Dance.
Cool.
We're going to see them in action here, yeah. We have Larak the Lash, given the honor of carrying the Queen's dragon banner. Then we have Tumko Lo.
My favorite. Black as Maester's ink he was, but fast and strong. The best natural swordsman Selmy had seen since Jaime Lannister.
The best natural swordsman since Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
That is a really big compliment.
Yeah.
And this is coming from Barristan, who is an incredible swordsman himself. So we'll keep an eye on him, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the Red Lamb, a ferocious Lazarine, unusual amongst his normally peaceful culture.
Yeah, he seems to be pretty quotable. We're really looking forward to reading his dialogue. He's the one that, you know, said that I came for blood, not gold.
Yeah. So far, we've listed people whose loyalty to Dany can't be doubted. Their motivations don't really need to be explained. They're loyal to Dany, and that's pretty much it. The rest of the players in this battle, however, are not so certain.
Yeah, I mean, we'll start with the pit fighters. I mean, we're reasonably sure that they can be trusted, and Barristan does think the same. Dany is the one who freed them, and if her side is not victorious, the best they can hope for is enslavement, and many would be tortured to death.
Yeah. Many are loyal to Hizdar as owner of all the fighting pits as well. He's kind of their employer, in a sense. And indeed, we're told that Barristan is kind of hearing them yelling, as they kind of yell out a battle cry, whatever. More of them are yelling out for Hizdar than for Dany. So take that for how you will.
In any case, though, they're only about two to 300, not two men to 300, 200 to 300, to be clear. We're not that, like, what a great estimate we had. But we're told they'll fight alongside the few Dothraki that didn't join the search for Dany.
Right on. Then we have the Stormcrows. They're a unit of 500 cavalry, if that wasn't known. Daario is a hostage, so they're joint commanded by a man called the Widower, a scarred axeman, and Jokin, a veteran archer.
He's joking all the time.
Yeah, he is. He's a laugher and a joker.
We expect them to remain loyal, and Daario himself, I mean, is obviously quite loyal to Dany for obvious personal reasons.
Yeah. Furthermore, Barristan has sent the Dornish Knights Archibald Ironwood and Garrus Drinkwater, Quentin's companions, of course, I'm sure you remember, along with the same, with some previously unreleased / imprisoned Windblown to treat with the Tattered Prince, the same ones that accompanied Quentin during his fake betrayal mission that turned real, and so those guys got thrown in jail, and blah, blah, blah. He has told the Knights to offer what the Tattered Prince wants most of all, which is the city of Pentos. As an aside, it seems not unlikely that Illyrio is on bad terms with the Tattered Prince. We don't know about any background between them, but it seems like Illyrio and Varys would have been coming up, kind of getting, or had already just come up around the time that the Tattered Prince fled from Pentos. So we don't know what about the connection between those two, but we got to feel like there's something.
The Tattered Prince will accept this offer and consider himself very lucky. Why so sure? Because he intended to defect to her side in the first place.
Yep.
I mean, he made multiple attempts to talk to Dany or her people in secret about turning their cloaks, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
Quentin Martell ruined one of those attempts when he turned his cloak himself.
Yeah. Irony. The service that Barristan expects for Pentos being given to the Tattered Prince is twofold. The first, of course, is to bring Pretty Maris and Kago Corpse Killer and all those other colorfully named Windblown and their 3,000 men over to Dany and Barristan's side.
Mm-hmm. The second is to rescue Dario, Hero, and Jogo.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, they would use their feigned loyalty to get close to the hostages and then make their play for rescue. Then they'd join the battle immediately afterwards.
Now, we have other sellsword companies, of course. Probably the biggest unnamed one that we've learned a lot about is the Second Sons.
We know they flipped to the Yunkish side not too long ago, and they conned Dany out of some extra wealth on their way out.
Yeah.
But Tyrion, Ser Jorah, and rapidly changing circumstances are pushing a Brown Van Plum to, you know, consider reflipping his, he has like 500 some odd cavalry,
mm-hmm,
back to Dany, despite his fears that she'll kill him in the Volantine fleet.
Yeah. That's the big wild card that's bothering him in general.
Yeah.
The Long Lances are a group of 800 cavalry, and we don't really know much about them. They're sort of the odd man out as far as all the sellsword companies, as far as getting mentioned. Their commander even is apparently kind of a mumbler when he's talking, so I guess it's kind of fitting. They are probably loyal to the Yunkish, but they're sellswords. They could change sides in the middle of the battle, if they're not like wiped out first or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So. Then they're the Company of the Cat. I like that name.
Yeah,
it's 3,000 men commanded by Bloodbeard. Also like that name.
Bloodbeard.
Bloodbeard wants to sack Meereen, and he wants to reap huge rewards. This the kind of witch that he wouldn't get from Dany. She doesn't want to sack a city, really.
Yeah.
He also hates the Tattered Prince, as he and his men fought on opposite sides in a recent campaign.
Yeah.
On top of all of that, Bloodbeard, I mean, he's specifically the man who threw Grolio's head at the foot of the throne.
Mm.
So that means they're highly unlikely to switch sides. Barristan specifically wants to kill him.
Yeah.
And he tells Dany never to trust him. So as long as Barristan is commanding them, definitely they're not switching.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
even
yeah,
with Dany, they're definitely pretty much not switching.
Mm-hmm. It seems very doubtful. They're, even though they're a sellsword company, they've really committed themselves to the other side for a lot of reasons. Now we have the slave soldiers and related allies to the Yunkish. There's the Giskari legions, who are a quality cells, rather they're quality slave soldiers, unlike some of the other ones we've seen. They're not necessarily no match for the Unsullied, but they are more numerous at least. We also have all these minor lords with anywhere from, we're told, 20 to 2,000 soldiers, anywhere in between. There's the Herons, the Girl General, the Little Pigeon, the Perfumed Hero, and other such completely unintimidating ridiculousness, etc. There's also 100 elephants with towers and archers on the back. There's a corps of Carthine camelry. Camel warriors. That sounds cool.
Yeah.
And then we have the Talasi slingers, so we see them in action a bit, practicing with their lead balls. And Tyrion mentions how badass they are.
All of these guys are really disorganized, though. I mean, the Yunkish and their allies had besieged Astapor prior to this, as we know. And when the Astapori sallied forth, it caught the Yunkish completely by surprise. Only the disciplined and prepared sellsword companies, in tandem with the legions from New Geese, turned the tide.
Yeah. This will probably turn out to be foreshadowing, because the same thing is going to happen, most likely. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not the Iron Fleet is truly an ally for Dany, they're certainly an enemy of the Yunkish and their allies.
Yes.
Here's a good quote.
Yes. The noble lady was a tub of a ship. As fat and wallowing as the noble ladies of the Greenlands. Her holds were huge, and Victorian packed them with armed men. I do like the tub of a ship.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
I always do.
But not just the noble lady. The Iron Fleet's best fighters are all stuffed into fishing boats, merchant cogs, and other very mundane, unthreatening vessels.
The idea is to allow the warships under the Yunkai to board, as they normally would, to inspect their holds, etc. You don't approach a city under siege by land and sea unmolested. Like, by air.
And they're counting on that specifically.
The hidden Iron Man would burst forth and board the enemy vessel and take control of it. Trojan ships.
There you go. Presumably they do this as many times as they can while overwhelming the others with the new ships plus the real Iron Fleet, which will arrive sometime after the second wave. Like a Trojan horse, maybe. So we have, they'll proceed to land and assault the slaver armies on land.
Victorian, with the weaker part of his men but the stronger part of his fleet, is waiting a predetermined length of time to join the battle, and he's giving the Trojan horse ships the time to do their job. And of course, he has Dragon by him to think of.
Mokoro might have some kind of impact on the battle. We've yet to see a red priest in a pitched battle. Melisandre was not at the Battle of Blackwater, but she stated with no uncertainty, of course she's always confident, but she stated with no uncertainty that had she been there, Stannis would have won. We're not sure what exactly was she, but remember during the battle at the wall, she just incinerates Aurel the Eagle. So, like, she's clearly capable of doing some stuff in the battle.
So. Mokoro would definitely want Dany's side to win, Mokoro may not be more powerful than Melisandre, but he has been much more accurate with his readings.
Yeah.
His interpretations of his accurate readings, especially. And he did the burned hand thing to Victorian. So, wild card.
Wild card Mokoro. His loyalty to Dany is, like we said a few times, is pretty much unquestionable. His superior, Bonero, the head red priest at Atlantis, seemed to have this is a new term, I like this, a zealot's confidence that she is Azor Ahai. So when you're a religious person, you believe someone else is the savior of your religion, you're loyal to them. Okay, yeah, I don't think we need to explain that much further.
So Mokoro is really well placed to help Dany, basically.
Yeah, if anything goes wrong or, anything goes right, he's right there. So the last thing George reads in this Victorian chapter before we get into as far as what he officially released is this great quote here to Mokoro. "Go pray to your red god. Light your fire and tell me what you see." Makoro's dark eyes seem to shine. "I see dragons."
At least he doesn't see dead people. Another wild card is the Volantine fleet, of course. It's much larger than the Greyjoy fleet, even with those that he has just capped. I mean, Victorian sees it himself when they're in Port of Volantis. I mean, they could have been slowed by the same storms that scattered his own fleet, but they still could. They still have 300 ships filled with slave soldiers not far away. Victorian's plan involves getting in and out before they arrive. He wants to get in and out, grab Dany.
Yeah, snatch and grab. Standard, problem, right? It's actually, of course, it's quite bold, worthy of the Ironborn, I'd say. But also his only choice, perhaps. I mean, the Shave Pate tells Barristan that Hisdar was planning on welcoming the Volantine fleet and their armies, opening the gates to them. So once the slave armies are inside Meereen, then Victorian doesn't really have any chance of getting Dany. But Hisdar isn't going to give any orders about opening the gate at the moment because he's still in prison.
Biggest wild card of all, more than Mokoro, more than the Volantine fleet, are the dragons themselves. They could attack the Yunkish, they could attack Dany's people, they could do both, they could burn the ships, they could just scare people off just by coming near.
And this is before the horn is blown. After that, it'll either get better or worse, or... and at the point where the battle is basically getting ready to start, or just after, it's kind of unclear, they are patrolling the skies above the city, catching these plague-infested corpses as they fly over, as they flip and flop over and through the air. The dragons burn them in midair like they do in those fish in that scene at the beginning of season 3. Kind of like that, except they're doing it to corpses and catching them and eating them in midair. So
also a cool
hopefully
scene.
We get to see that on TV. That is cool.
Yes. I wouldn't think that that's too dark or gory for Game of Thrones.
No, I don't think so. It's just a dragon eating a dead body.
Yeah, a bunch of dead bodies.
A bunch of them, yeah. So, all right, let's think about now for a minute how all these varied forces and armies, how they're arrayed, where they're at when the battle starts, basically the layout. Meereen is basically surrounded, though it took some time for the Yunkish and a general, yet more commentary on how disorganized they are. It's kind of one of those too many chefs spoil the soup kind of deal. And there's so it took some time for them to kind of surround the city. There's also the refugees, who a lot of them who are plague victims, either are already plague victims or are soon to be because they're surrounded by plague. So they kind of form a bit of a neutral zone. The Yunkish were kind of keeping them near the city at a distance, kind of throwing stones at them, slinging at them, shooting at them, keeping them from leaving. So Danny's kind of forced to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, Danny couldn't bring them inside, and no one wants to go near them, but the Yunkish prevented them from going elsewhere. And that's purely to cause problems for Dany and her armies. They're, you know, you could say they're leveraging her sympathy, which, I mean, obviously she has sympathy for people.
Yeah, so they're like making, it's kind of puts a strain on her resources a bit. So we can kind of consider them a bit of a neutral zone. No one wants to go near them. So the battle won't, they won't probably be much of an impact in the battle at all. Now, we also have, of course, we just mentioned the trebuchets flinging corpses into the city. There's six of them active, and they each have a nickname.
Yeah. We also have dragons flying above. They're not hurting any living people yet. They're just hanging around, flying around, making things interesting, intimidating everyone. And then we also have slave soldiers that we mentioned all over. Many more on the way from Volantis. Then we have the Yunkish allied sellswords in reserve. Barristan expects these to counterattack when he charges, much as they did in Astapor.
And then, of course, finally, we have the very unthreatening fleet that's approaching, and that, of course, is filled with Ironborn. And, of course, once they land, they're going to do their sneak attack thing on the slavers and their ships, and boarding and taking over as many of those as possible. Mm-hmm. All right, now we can get into the actual action of the battle. Actual action. Barristan's men gather in the large market square beside the western gate.
He perceives that some of the men fear the diseased corpses. I mean, who wouldn't fear that?
Yeah, it's scary.
And he perceives that many of them are facing their first battle. He addresses them with confidence, giving them, I mean, of course he does, he's been in plenty of battles.
Mm-hmm.
He gives a speech to lift their spirits. We're looking forward to seeing that speech ourselves, reading it ourselves. He's wearing his new Queensguard armor, and he's riding Dany's silver. How nice.
Mm-hmm.
As he thinks a symbol of her presence will boost morale. He no doubt cuts an impressive figure, and along with his reputation, as he makes for an inspiring leader. I mean, no doubt the story of him slaying Kraz in single combat has spread, and that helps, because not like people there know about his escapades in Westeros. Really.
Yeah, they've only heard that he's...
They know that he's a good fighter, but
yeah.
They don't know that he went and saved King Aerys, you know, himself. They don't know that.
They don't know about that, but they do know that he just killed a famous pit fighter 40 years younger than him in one-on-one combat, so... That definitely is going to give him a little credibility if he didn't already have it. Of the speech itself, we know very little, but we hear it's particularly excellent, so we have that to look forward to. He thinks to himself that a leader should never speak of defeat before a battle, because you never know when the gods might be listening. And we hear that Lord Commander Gerald Hightower, the commander of the Kingsguard many years ago, is the one who told him that.
Mm-hmm. While others, as we said, were showing a fear of death, whether from the corpses or from the battle, the Red Lamb claims to have no fear of death. You could say he's going like a lamb to the slaughter. As it will give him a chance to meet his people's god, he says, who's called the Great Shepherd. And this is something that I quite like, is that he says, he at that point, he plans to break his shepherd's crook in two, while demanding to know why he created such a peaceful race in such a violent world. And I think that's something a lot of people can identify with.
Yeah.
Miri Mazdoor was the Lazarine too, by the way.
Mm-hmm. That's right, so they have that in common. The charge, the signal that Barristan has arranged for the charge, that because, as we said, there's a charge happening out of three different gates, so they have to have some sort of signal to unite them so they know when to do it. And it's a fire atop one of the pyramids. I assume it's the Great Pyramid, the tallest pyramid in town. But that's not specifically mentioned. So while he goes out the western gate, other forces are charging out of the northern and southern gates towards the main Yunkish forces. He has his three squires by his side. Leric is bannerman, while Red Lamb is charged with blowing his horn at certain key moments, either to cause advancing or retreating. The Unsullied are valuable and skilled troops, as we know, but even they can't, you know, march in formation through the gates and keep their ranks like that. So they need time to kind of filter out of the gates and get into formation. And Barristan's charge with the pit fighters just behind is partly designed to give the Unsullied time to kind of form up and get into their ranks.
Yeah. And of course, we mentioned that one of the ways that we see we figure out the chapter order, in addition to what George actually said, is the time of day that we see. Here's an example where Barristan notes that the dawn will be upon them very soon. Thus, it's still dark. He thinks that it'll be a dragon dawn.
Dragon dawn.
Yes.
That's cool.
Meanwhile, though, out on Slaver's Bay, the sea was smooth and still, the sky bright with stars. Victarion, perhaps while Barristan is giving a speech, sends his men into battle as well, reminding Wolf One Ear of their plan. He says, "The slavers may shiver when they spy your sails rising from the sea," he told them. "Once they see you, plain, they will laugh at their fears. Traders and fishers, that's all you are. Any man can see that. Let them get close as they like, but keep your men hidden below decks until you are ready. Then close, and board them. Free the slaves and feed the slavers to the sea, but take the ships. We will have need of every haul to carry us back home." And then Victarion goes below deck to talk Dragonhorn blowing with his thralls. And then we have Tyrion, meanwhile, playing Syvas with Brown Van Plum once again. Tyrion suggests they turn on the Yunkai and claim to Dany that this was their plan all along, i.e. that they had pretended to switch sides. The problem is that his plan to demonstrate loyalty to Daenerys is exactly what Barristan sent the Windblown to do. Free the hostages. That's what Tyrion's plan is, but that's already going to be accomplished.
Someone thought of that already, Tyrion.
Yeah. At some point, and again later, a second son tells Brown Ben that new ships are arriving. He ignores this, assuming that it's the Volantine fleet. Of course there are ships arriving, the Volantines are coming. But he's wrong, and soon enough, Ser Jorah then bursts into the tent and declares that a Greyjoy fleet is here.
Around then, this is when Barristan and his men are actually riding out through the Western Gate. Despite his experience, he is nervous. But because of his experience, he knows the nervousness will vanish when time slows down in the chaos of battle. That might be an actual quote from the book. Barristan thinks that much of this attack goes against his instincts. They're charging into a larger force and both relying on sellswords to fight alongside him and to betray his enemies. That's the Second Sons and the Windblown, respectively. Mm. But it's not that simple. And he doesn't yet know that the Iron Fleet has become a huge help, at least in the short term.
Dany Silver is really fast. And Barristan riding in, he begins to outpace his squires and the Stormcrows. This pleases him, as he intends to strike the first blow himself, before the Widower, who also intends to do so, apparently.
Yeah.
He takes heart, as he notices, as was foreshadowed, that the youngish forces are completely unprepared for this attack.
Yeah. Soon they're only 30 yards from the Harridan, which is one of the trebuchets. I think it's the largest of the trebuchets. And he, before any sort of resistance starts to form against them, so they've gotten almost to their target, and that's finally when the youngish actually start to do something. We're told that the sky fills with arrows briefly, and a squire for the Stormcrows is killed. Barristan himself takes a bolt to his shield, and Laric is hit in the chest, but regains his saddle and keeps the banner held up high. Nice going.
Mm-hmm. And then the Red Brant Lamb blows the horn as planned. Barristan looks back to see the pit fighters emerge from the city gates, making enough noise for 10 times their number. He notes that one of them is bare-breasted and wearing a python, even.
What?
Yeah, and he decides she won't live through today.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and agree with him there.
Their job is to intimidate while screening the Unsullied as they march forth.
Yeah. So by now, Barristan expects that there should have been a counterattack by the Yunkish. At least by the sellswords, because they're organized and disciplined. They're professional soldiers, after all. They're not slaves. We already know why the Second Sons might be holding back. And the Windblown as well. But the Long Lances in the Company of the Cat, the ones that we said that are almost certainly going to stay loyal to the Yunkish, those are the ones we would have expected to see come and meet Barristan's charge and deal with him. But they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the general disorganization that he was expecting was actually even worse than he thought.
Better
for him, yeah. But we know the real reason is that it's because of the Ironborn having arrived.
Yeah. The Ironborn have seized several Yunkish ships, and others have put ashore and are attacking the Yunkai from behind. And so this is what the Company of the Cat and the Long Lances are likely dealing with.
Yep.
But this is just the first wave of Ironborn. Back on the Iron Victory, Vicarion is rubbing his own blood on the horn in an attempt to claim it with blood. That sounds really funny.
My horn. Mine. I'm going to rub it on there with blood. I'm guessing it doesn't work that way. Anyway, he also, finger bangs the dusky woman.
Maybe with his new burned hands.
Burning sensation for her pleasure. Bad idea to have sex before a battle, he thinks. He goes back on deck and gives his men a rousing speech. I'm guessing he's not as eloquent as Barristan, but he's probably just as rousing, to consider who his audience is. Mm-hmm. And he gets his men fired up, I'm guessing. Meanwhile, Tyrion is going back to put on his armor while Brown Ben rides off to consult with the girl general. Many of the Second Sons are unhappy about being on the Yunkish side. Mm-hmm. Ser Jorah, obviously, would be chief amongst those.
Mm-hmm. So then a man in golden armor, he rides up claiming to speak for Supreme Commander Gorzak. But no one knows who the hell that is. I mean, who? Gorzak. Yeah. There hasn't been a Supreme Commander since Yerkaz Zoyunzak was trampled to death while attending the fighting pits. This envoy commands them to attack the savages from the squid ships, but they call that silly, as they can't run their horses on water. What are you thinking?
Tyrion also thinks that, in general, it would be a terrible idea to fight the Ironborn. Like, yep, correct, Tyrion, you're right, that's a terrible idea. So they tell the emissary that they don't want to seem like cowards or whatever, and the whole line about riding horses on water was kind of just a way to kind of deflect. But basically, they come up with a better excuse, which is, we got to wait for our captain to come back before deciding what to do. We can't just ride off into battle without our captain. He needs to tell us what to do. So they tell him that. He's not happy about that answer. Says, swearing that Gorzak will be angry with them. We still don't know who Gorzak even is. Mm-hmm. Tyrion and Jorah are now even more convinced that they are on the wrong side. So Viserion, by the way, has now withdrawn. Rhaegal is still roaming the skies, eating plague corpses, I suppose. But Viserion is withdrawn, so we're not sure what's up with that.
Barristan is now very close to the Harrodin, the Trebuchet. But Giscari Slave Legion, apparently 6,000 men strong, has formed up in front of it. They're six ranks deep and bristling with spears. Yes, like porcupines.
Like a hedgehog, exactly.
The bane of a cavalry charge. Barristan decides to veer off and aim for a weaker part of the enemy lines.
Well, we named a bunch of silly slaver lords before, so let no one be surprised when we tell you that Barristan picks one of them as the weak point. He goes for the Harrens, those ridiculous tall slaves mounted on stilts. I mean, come on. Wow, so ridiculous.
Love that. So much.
He believes dawn will blind them. There's how we know what time it is, basically. Yeah. And he cuts the head off the first Harren he meets. I guess he had to reach really high for that. He's sitting on a horse, so
yeah,
I guess that helped.
Yeah.
The silver, Danny Silver, knocks into another Harren and he falls down and knocks three more over. That sounds kind of like dominoes.
That would be a funny scene. I hope they have the Harrens. Yeah,
if they have that on TV, that'll be a little comic relief there, I guess.
And then the Red Lamb catches the little pigeon himself, more animals, who begs for mercy while claiming that he will fetch a large ransom. And this is where the Red Lamb says, "I came for blood, not gold." And that's where then the little pigeon has his head smashed in by the Red Lamb's mace.
Bam. Yeah. Blood apparently flies all over, getting on Barristan's horse. Well, Danny's horse. So Barristan looks back to the gates again and sees that the Unsullied have begun to march out and form up. He notes that he sees one take a crossbow bolt through the throat and fall dead, but it doesn't slow them down at all. They're disciplined and professional.
Doesn't slow that guy down. He keeps walking.
Yeah, that guy too. He just gets up and keeps going. So this is when Tumko Lo, the best natural swordsman he's seen since Jaime Lannister, points out the extra ships out in the bay.
Apparently he also has a good set of eyes.
Yeah, apparently. At least better than Barristan. Like Brown Ben, Barristan's first thought is that the Valentine fleet has come, and he's kind of sad about that.
Yeah, his heart sinks at the thought. He's probably like, oh, this is it. This is the end. And he has Tumko describe the banners to him, and Tumko responds, "Squids. Big squids, like in the Basilisk Isles, where sometimes they drag whole ships down." Barristan replies, "Where I'm from, we call them Krakens."
And he exalts, thinking that they have the Yunkish caught in between. He thinks of Prince Baelor Breakspear and Prince Maekar, who, at the Battle of Redgrass Field, were the hammer and the anvil, catching the rebels between them. And he thinks it's just like that. And he's just, you know, filled with excitement.
Oh, my great joy, I love.
So, yeah, Barristan may not be thinking of them as allies soon enough. But for now, it looks good. You know, we know what Vicarion's really got in mind, so that could change quickly. Yeah. So the last selection of chapter readings show us Brown Ben returning to the Second Son's camp, telling his men that they are ordered by the Girl General to defend one of the trebuchets. Another nobleman rides up wearing armor with depraved scenes of which Tyrion approves. they must be having sex or something. That must be for Tyrion to approve.
Yeah, certainly.
He comes up swearing vengeance on the Prince of Tatters, which is likely because of the planned betrayal that we mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Tyrion mocks the Lord, and perhaps he's intending to provoke a conflict.
Forcing the issue, as we said before.
Yes, forcing the issue. He's likely realized just how desperate they are now. They absolutely must switch sides, no matter Ben's reservations and the fact that their rescue of the hostage plan is no longer viable.
This apparently works, and it comes to blows, meaning the forcing the issue. Brown Ben holds the man off, giving Ser Jorah a chance to kill him. No doubts. Now, they are definitely on Dany's side again. They just killed some important lord of the Yunkish, and
But so anyways, it appears that since this nobleman was bitching about the tattered prince, it seems the Windblown have done their job. Though Barristan doesn't know this yet. We expect Daario, Hero, and Jogo to be safe.
Yes.
To be safe.
Yeah, we expect so, but you know, there could always be a twist. Maybe the Windblown have their own agenda and Daario winds up dead somehow.
I just want Daario dead. I don't like Daario either. I don't want a Hero or Jogo dead.
Yeah, I think I'd like to see Daario live a little longer. I'm not a big fan of his, but I think he has some more cool stuff to do. It wouldn't be a worthy death for him to die in captivity.
That's true.
Now, Tyrion himself probably wanted to take credit for getting the Second Sons to flip again. He needed something to kind of prove himself to Daenerys besides murdering his own father. but it seems like he's going to get upstaged by Victarion because it kind of looks like they switched sides because the Ironborn showed up. It doesn't necessarily look like they did, you know, they were, you know, had some other plan in mind. But that said, the Second Sons played it smart. They didn't kill a single one of Dany's people. So it's not like Dany can really fault them for being actually committed enemies. So switching back might actually work. Brown Ben is nervous, and I'd agree that he should be nervous. But they do really have some good things going for them.
Mm-hmm. He can return whatever money he needs to.
That's true. That's the money that he kind of fleeced from Dany. He can just give it right back and say, "I never." I never.
I had to make it convincing. So Tyrion seems to have a large hurdle or two left to climb before Dany accepts him. Mm. I mean, his brother killed Dany's father, and Ser Barristan didn't really like Ser Jaime very much either, as much as he could respect his skill with the sword.
Yeah.
Tyrion's father, you know, he seems to, Daenerys certainly thinks that he ordered the deaths of Dany's niece, nephew, and aunt. It doesn't look so good, even though he killed Tywin himself, which goes a long way, but Dany is, she's committed to always saying the usurper's dogs, to always, she really hates everyone and all that.
Yeah,
she thinks was involved with it.
It won't be so easy. Tyrion's going to have to demonstrate some value. I think maybe the dragons, you know, his knowledge of dragons might be what he does.
Yeah,
but
the dragons accepting him?
The dragons accepting him, like, kind of the way Brown Ben, I think it was Viserion, flew over to him when he was, you know, just this big. And Danny's like, oh, he likes you, you know, and some people thought, well, and then he goes on to describe his dragon blood, his drop or two drops of dragon blood, and maybe that's the reason. So if Tyrion has any dragon blood, which we're certainly going to go into that whole conspiracy theory about him being a bastard of Aerys, but if he is, this would be a good way to prove that it's the case. So,
simpler answer, of course, as he's mentioned a little bit, is that he can simply just show off his knowledge of dragons, which is something that Dany does have a distinct need for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't see it in these readings, but perhaps Tyrion even knows what to do about the Dragonborn. I mean, I don't think that's so likely, but he certainly knows things that Daenerys would like to know.
Definitely.
That no one else can tell her at this point.
He as far back as his first or second chapter in Game of Thrones, he's borrowing books from the Stark Library about dragons. He's just reading. So he's read a lot. He's possibly the most knowledgeable person regarding dragons, period. He probably knows more than a lot of the maesters, because from our maester episode, you guys know that most of the maesters are not They don't want to think about that kind of thing.
Probably the second most likely person to know a lot about dragons is Marwyn the Mage. So he's also going to Dany, so maybe Dany meets Marwyn. She's like, I don't need you, Tyrion.
Yeah, so but, a lot of really cool possibilities there. So as far as the horn, she said, she's not so confident that he knows a lot about it. But if he does, or even if he doesn't, he can claim to. He can say, I can help with this dragon horn issue. I've read these books. And he might say that as a lie just to buy himself time. Like, if his alternative is to be eaten by a dragon or killed in some other way, or lie to stay alive, we know which one he'll pick.
Yes. At this point, though, we are past what we know from the readings, and we're dealing with predictions and theories.
Yeah.
So let's clarify where the three point of views are. So as we just saw, Tyrion has just accomplished the first part of his goal, which is getting the second sons to change sides. His second goal is, we've also just discussed, that's getting Dany to accept him. A big question, though, is how Ser Jorah fits into all this. What's Dany going to think of Jorah? Is Jorah going to argue for Tyrion, against Tyrion? Would it be better if he argued for or against him in Dany's
eyes?
Will she
listen to what Jorah's saying?
Like, maybe if Jorah argues against Tyrion, that's good for Tyrion because Dany just like hates Jorah. So, well, definitely that's where we are with Tyrion.
I would think Tyrion shouldn't be like, hey, look, I brought Ser Jorah back to you. Don't start with that one. So they'll have kind of varied and perhaps unpredictable reactions to both Ser Jorah, Tyrion, and Brown Ben. All three of them are going to kind of elicit some strong reactions. And then we have maybe Victarion. Yeah. She has to react to him eventually, potentially. Mm-hmm. So we'll see about that.
So then we have Barristan, who right now believes they're solidly winning the battle. I mean, the wind blown, the Second Sons have come over to their side, the Unsullied are in formation, but, you know, he's broken through part of the Yunkish lines, and the Ironborn, something he didn't ever predict, are doing all sorts of damage.
So things are going great! Yeah, well, that means something bad is probably about to happen. Something terrible, really awful.
Don't say that.
Like, maybe the Valentine fleet does arrive right then, or maybe the dragon horn gets blown right about then. Something bad.
But speaking of the horn, this is about where we might expect to see that second Victarion chapter again. The action might not come from his point of view. I mean, we obviously don't know for sure. But what we do know for sure is that he waited behind with his second wave of troops and his ships and Dragonbinder, jealous of those he sent ahead to strike the first blow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, last we saw, he gave his men a speech, and then sailed to join the action. I think the horn might be blown around this time as he comes ashore, perhaps just before.
Here's what the Iron Captain has in mind. He gathers three thralls and offers them rich rewards for one hornblow apiece.
Mm-hmm. Of course, he doesn't realize that he only needs two hornblows.
Apparently, yeah.
He's being thorough. The Drogon's gone, but yeah. The three thralls are a boy, a brute, and a bastard's bastard.
Lots of bees.
Yes. He tells them, blow the horn until you are too weak to stand, until the last bit of breath has been squeezed from you, until your lungs are burning. Let the freedmen hear you in Meereen, the slavers in Yunkai, the ghosts in Aztapor. Let the monkeys shit themselves at the sound when it rolls across the Isle of Cedars. Then pass the horn along to the next man. Do you hear me? Do you know what to do?
Remember how awful and just how sorcerously loud that thing was, the description of
it? Theon would hate it.
Theon would really hate it. Just regular war horns were keeping him up at night. This thing would just give him nightmares. So
he has more things to have nightmares about at this point.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Loud sounds probably don't bother him too much. He's going to be thinking about his missing, you know what.
His missing horn.
His human horn.
Yeah.
So that horn, it could really distract people in the battle. I mean, people it could distract. It can confuse them. I don't think anyone's going to mistake it for the horn that Red Lamb blows, but, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
But it could easily, as much more damage likely as it could do to mess with the people and their organization and their just, the way it feels. Like Victarion felt like he was being burned from the inside when he heard it blowed. So, and Victarion's a tough guy. Like, these are, you know, what is it going to do to these other people? But think about the animals. The animals in the battlefield, like the horses especially, could be freaked out by this. There's also the elephants and the camels, which we haven't even seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
So That is just a, you know, a lot of opportunity for chaos there.
I mean, this could go, it could go really well for them. We're not using any animals at all. You know, and the animals could cause chaos. And chaos could be their ladder.
Oh, yes. Chaos is the ladder. Nice. So we know that many of Barristan's forces are relying on horns as a signal, like I said. So it's possible Dragonbinder throws them off, causes a retreat that's not supposed to happen, or causes someone to advance when they're not supposed to. But the horn sound, like I said before, it's kind of unique, so it may not have that effect, but it could, so that's an interesting thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, it could go really badly as well, though. Perhaps Rhaegal and Viserion come and burn the Iron Fleet.
Whoops. In general, I kind of doubt the dragons are just going to come over to Victorian and lie down in front of him meekly, saying, okay, what is your bidding, master? So, but it could have, like, a calming effect, despite how hellacious and, you know, just intimidating it sounds. I mean, dragons sleep in volcanoes, after all. We've heard about that. So if a volcano can be comfortable, then that sound might actually be soothing.
And, of course, we know that Victorian is probably doing Euron's will right now, and that they both mean to take Dany by force, but Mikoro seems to be Dany's honest ally. Euron and Mikoro are both pulling strings on the same puppet, so that creates a bunch of possibilities. So, is there any chance the Ironborn attack Dany's people? Unlikely. Victorian's men know not to attack anyone flying dragon banners. They want to steal the queen, which will never happen if they appear hostile to her people.
Yeah, as soon as they start attacking Dany's people, there's no, they lose all access to her in general. As for the opposite, though, the Iron Fleet seems to have dragon banners of their own. In other words, will Barristan's men attack the Ironborn? The answer is most likely no. They've already seen them as allies, most likely, and of course the dragon banners should ensure that there's no confusion there. And since he needs to snatch Dany and get away before the Volantine fleet arrives, he's going to have a problem because she's not there. She's, you know, out in the Dothraki Sea, which until recently Victorian thought was a sea. And if the dragons are causing problems, though, by the way, if the dragons are just flying around doing all sorts of chaos, causing problems because the horn's been blown,
He may not even be able to find out that Dany's not there because his fleet's being burned and him with it.
He'll have bigger problems to deal with, indeed.
So, I mean, he has no immediate way to complete his mission. We have three point of views at this location now, with Dany returning eventually. So, I mean, that alone could spell doom for the Iron Captain. Three point of views converging, one survived. <no? Yeah>. So, Barristan might not live a whole lot longer either. But, I mean, I think Aziz agrees, that his story is more interesting if he survives long enough to be conflicted about Aegon VI. His claim supersedes Dany's, and Barristan has always felt shame about the death of Rhaegar's children. So Barristan himself could actually be one of Dany's three treasons.
Yeah, the first treason may have killed her son and or her call. In other words, it was huge, so she's thought in her mind about what some of the three betrayals could have been or what they could be. But the one that we're kind of sure of was really big. So Jorah, like, betraying her wasn't really that big. And the Brown Ben flipping didn't turn out big at all. He's flipped back without killing one of her soldiers.
Didn't hurt her at all.
Yeah, it didn't really hurt. It kind of pissed her off. But as far as, you know, got people
hurt
mad. It hurt her feelings. Yeah,
she
so
likes Brown Ben. The dragons like him.
With his strange dead eyes and his big smile. But so it seems like something big has to happen as far as a treason. And, you know, as unlikely as it is for Barristan to turn on her, well, that would certainly
that would be big.
That would be
the one time that he would maybe turn on her is Aegon.
Yeah, and the other potential bugaboo there is... bugaboo? I don't know why I use that word. Is that Barristan was in love with Ashara Dane. And for some reason, George threw that in his last chapters there at the end of Dance, pointing that out. Some people think Septa Lamar, the Septa in the company with Aegon and John Connington, is Ashara Dane. I don't know how that could be because the eye color, Tyrion never notices her eye color and it's supposed to be really purple. But if it is her, Barristan's in love with her. He's going to have a really hard time being against her, fighting her. And that could be, you know, treason for love.
That's true.
So is it possible that Daenerys just shows up during this battle? We discussed it briefly earlier in the episode. Is it possible that she shows up? Well, we think it's not very likely, but if it does happen,
it'd be cool. But
what would happen there?
I mean, I wouldn't complain if she came riding in on Drogon with a large group of Dothraki with her, and I do think that she'll come there. But it's more likely that she's going to head to face Dothrak first, because she sees the following vision way back at the House of the Undying.
Between the Mother of Mountains, rather, beneath the Mother of Mountains, a line of naked crones crept from a great lake and knelt shivering before her. Their gray heads bowed. The great lake would be what the Dothraki call the womb of the world. Perhaps they've gone into the lake because Drogon burned everything.
It certainly seems like they're submitting to her. That seems hard to doubt.
Yeah, they're kneeling to her in a line. Oh, yeah, that seems. I agree with you there. The Khaleesi may fly forth from Base Dothrak with a massive Khalasar and are having caused much devastation to the Dothraki home.
Yeah.
She is the true stallion who mounts the world, uniting all the peoples of the world into one Khalasar. Well, Dothraki, Unsullied, Shavepates, Freedmen, all, you know, Giscari, Westerosi, Carthene, you know, Pentashi, Bravosi, it's just a...
Lazarine,
that's what the prophecy says.
Yeah.
So, but let's not get too deep into that prophecy, we're saving that for another episode.
Yeah.
but more likely she comes later to Meereen. Now, it's important to note that even when this battle is over, the action around Meereen is not going to stop, because the Valentine fleet, once again, we keep talking about them. They're still on their way. Victarion saw them at Volantis getting ready to leave. The people were cheering them, being like, oh, the fleet is ready to go. They're all excited about the prospects of war and everything that the fleet is going to bring back in terms of riches and glory. So maybe she comes back after they've arrived or in time to deal with them. Something along those lines. It could be like a second battle of Meereen or something like that.
I like to imagine you're showing up, you know, a month late with coffee, like, anyone still here? And of course there won't be no one there. As much as the thought amuses me.
Yeah, that could be still Ironborn. Yeah. Could still be
there. Tens of thousands of enemy soldiers unaccounted for.
Yeah.
Plus those elephants.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they could still reform and pose a threat if enough survived the battle.
Which it looks like there would be, because there were a lot of legions, and that one legion guarding the Harridan, the trebuchet there, was 6,000. So there's several legions, and if they're anywhere the same size as that one, then that's quite a few soldiers unaccounted for. But last we saw Dany, she and Drogon were facing down Khal Jaqo, who might have Mago with him. And you might say Daenerys has an opinion on those two already. It was a cruel fate, Dany said, speaking of the slave girl Eroa she had saved previously. Yet not so cruel as Mago's will be. I promise you that. By the old gods and the new, by the lamb god and the horse god and every other god that lives, I swear it by the mother of the mountains and the womb of the world. Before I am done with them, Mago and Khal Jaqo will plead for the mercy they showed Eroa. So, yeah, it's not like these are just random Dothraki that are showing up.
So, wherever Dany's path takes her, though, it's near certain that she'll will wind back in Meereen, this time with the means to head back to Westeros. Between the Valentine fleets and the Greyjoy Navy, that should be enough.
That's
with
a
her
lot
dragons,
of ships.
With some Dothraki. Yeah.
If you're at all like me, though, you can't wait to see Victarion's point of view in battle again. That's almost certain to happen. I would be a little disappointed if it didn't. He's the biggest badass of badassdom, you know, to use the technical term. I mean, the guy would, quote, give half his teeth for the chance to try his axe against the Kingslayer or the Knight of Flowers. That was the sort of battle that he understood.
Funnily enough, if he fought them, as you pointed out when we were discussing it the other day, he fought the Knight of Flowers, the Kingslayer, right now. He could kill them both with one hand.
Take them both at the same time. Yeah. One's badly burned and the other doesn't have a sword hand, so yeah.
The guy legitimately wants to fight the best of the best, though. He genuinely loves battle.
I would really want to fight the best guys there are. Like, that's just awesome.
I mean, so far we've seen him duel Lord Ceri's young heir, and it was a good fight, but it was brief and probably a bit of a mismatch. Since it appears, though, that the company of the Cat is meeting the Ironborn in battle as they come ashore, we can hope for an epic duel, such as Victarion versus Bloodbeard.
Bloodbeard, yeah, that'd be great. Bloodbeard is described as a roaring giant with a ferocious appetite for slaughter. So a large, loud, a good fighter, he's a redhead.
You know, Victarion had to think for Ginger.
You folks didn't know that.
Yeah.
So anyway, that guy should really attract Vic's attention if he's looking and scanning the battle, looking for the
gingers.
For the gingers. Where are the gingers? I want to kill them all. He'll see the biggest ginger on the battlefield and go right for him.
Yes.
So hopefully Bloodbeard survives the first wave of Ironborn so that he can fight Victarion one-on-one, or at least Victarion can fight some badass. I really hope that happens. I think Vic would win that fight and would probably at least think, well, that was a worthy foe, at least. And maybe he takes a wound, maybe he takes a major wound, and that maybe reveals his nature. Like, you get to see him come back like Beric did, and that would maybe prove our theory or disprove it. If Mikoro has done more than affect his arm, you know, maybe he takes a mortal wound and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, after all, though, part of the prophecy apparently is that, you know, this is Binero's prophecy, that he says, and her triumph over darkness will bring a summer that will never end. Death itself will bend its knee, and all those who die fighting in her cause shall be reborn.
If he's fighting in her cause, I mean, I don't know how literal to take that, but all who die shall be reborn in her cause. That kind of sounds like what the others are doing, by the way, just bringing back all these whites. They didn't die in their cause, but they died and they're bringing them back. So it's, the magic kind of overlaps a bit here. It's something
Yeah,
we'll
it's
get into
really
another
the, but
episode.
definitely we're like we said, our religion episode, that's what we were supposed to be doing, but we got caught up in other things.
New material always
Yeah, new
supersedes old
material, yeah,
material.
basically, but our religion stuff will cover that. But there are some really interesting, it's the parallels between the Red God, between R'hllor and the Great Other, so to
Yeah,
say,
there's
and
more in common than you
fairy.
guys might
There's a
think.
lot in common. It's creepy.
It is very creepy. So consider our earlier comparison to Beric Dondarrion and imagine Victarion going through a similar event. Maybe we actually see him die in his own point of view and then see him wake back up with Makora standing above him, you know, chanting some words or, you know, burning him again or something like that. Just imagine that. It's kind of like, it would be kind of ironic, the drowned god, consider the drowned god's prayer and how Victarion might come back. What is dead may never die, but rises again, harder and stronger.
Yes. So that's all we have, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Certainly, we'll have another one coming out in about 2 weeks. We'll probably be releasing our religion episode. We might do some ANR to Magor discussion. We have a lot of stuff, a lot of documents in the pipeline. It's kind of just a matter of picking what to do first.
Yeah, we would love to do the religions one next to get that started. There's like, it's going to be a lot of episodes, and we'll probably like this. We'll probably,
one just on Weirwoods.
yeah, the next, the first one will be just on Weirwoods. There's enough material there to, we could probably more actually do two episodes on that, but it'll just be one. And we're also going to do our episodes on the tournaments, which will be coming up when we
Oh,
get into
yeah.
the Seven. And like Ashaya mentioned, we've got an episode on Aenar Targaryen to Maegor Targaryen, that time period.
Some nice ancient history.
Basically, because George gave some more material on that at another convention. So once again, new material kind of trumps old material in the order we want to put it out. Until the World of Ice and Fire book comes out, we're going to definitely focus less on history and more on predictions and analyzing the chapters, analyzing Dance with Dragon, kind of figuring out what's going to happen, that kind of stuff. Because
Just
the
plain
history,
religion stuff, which
yeah,
also isn't that tied into history.
right.
Religion is a little separate
I
from
kind of
that.
doubt there'll be a lot on the Weirwoods in this history book. There'll probably be a little bit, and it may force us to or encourage us to do some sort of addendum. But once the World of Ice and Fire book comes out, that's going to kind of turn our whole world upside down. In fact, in a good way. But we just don't want to, you know, of course, you can see why we'd be hesitant to put out material when something is going to come along and kind of overshadow it and
Blow
make
our
us want to do it
minds.
over. Yeah, blow our minds.
Yeah.
So.
So, be sure though to check us out on iTunes, depending on where you're listening, where you're watching.
Give us a rating,
Yes, give
please.
us
We
a
really,
rating.
those are really important for us. They help
If
us a
you're
lot.
watching on YouTube, give us a like, you know, share our videos and whatnot. Be sure check out the actual sources on where we found the chapters if you're interested. Maybe you noticed things that we didn't think were noteworthy.
Particular shout out to Azador from the forums there.
Be sure to meet up if you feel like it. Thank the people who they take the time to really take notes during these readings a lot of times, and they post it up for us, and they do a good service.
Yeah, so yeah, thanks to all those people. And for the people that helped discuss it to help us figure out what we were going to say. We, of course, a lot of this is conversations we have prior to the episode. We figure things out and kind of make up our own predictions and kind of chase each thread where we can take it. Of course, we're on Facebook, Westeros History at Facebook. What did I? That's
You
not
said
right.
history.
What history? I'll do that again.
Yes. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/history/Westeros History.
Twitter at Westeros History.
You can email us, westeroshistory@gmail.com.
Yes, you certainly email us questions or concerns or what you'd like to see in future episodes. We're working on a website. Speaking of the website, thanks to everybody who's donated so far. We really appreciate the donations.
We've got the website. We're working on the website. We're still trying to figure out some nitty-gritty details with it, but website itself is paid for at the moment, thanks to your guys' donations.
That's right,
next in the pipeline, one of the things that we're going to get is we're going to get a video camera.
Better camera,
because we're doing a lot. We have a lot of YouTube. We're using a nice webcam, but it can be better, basically.
And we're going to, part of our website is going to have forums. So once those are live, we'll be inviting you all to join us there.
Yes,
and
forums are the farthest along thing that we have right now.
Discuss potential future episodes, just general stuff about the books, whatever you want to talk about. We're going to try to do a few things a little differently. From other forums, just kind of, you know, just to give you guys a different look. But more on that when we're actually closer to that being real.
So I think that's it. So
I guess that is about it, everybody.
Rate it, like it, donate, and, you know, comment and tell us if you disagree, if you agree, whatever.
Yep, thanks a lot,
guys.
All right,
thanks a lot. We're just Westeros Podcast.
See you next time.